Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that the OMI in Bookomi stands for the original memorable insights that we find together in books written by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, arts, and culture. In this episode,
I'm Johan Norberg, author of Open, The Story of Human Progress. And this is my OMI for Bookomi.
We meet the historian of ideas and senior fellow of libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, who wants you to open your mind, your business, and your borders to celebrate and build upon the progress that we've made as humans to date.
We have this tendency to really enter into some sort of societal fight or flight instinct when we begin to think that we should pick fights with everybody, with scapegoats and with foreigners, and to flee the world behind walls and tariff barriers. And that's how most civilizations through history have vanished. And there is that risk today as well.
In Open, The Story of Human Progress, Johan Norberg says that we are the nicest and the nastiest of species. Each and every one of us a trader and a tribalist, globalist and nationalist, capable of open creative collaboration and closed vicious attacks on outsiders when we're feeling threatened by war, recessions, outsiders and pandemics. Johan, welcome to Bookomi.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, in your previous book, Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Towards the Future, you describe how we're living in a golden age of sorts and how well we've done in the last 200 years in terms of food, sanitation, poverty, literacy, etc. But the last 200 days don't look too great, do they? We're going to leap forward into the present. You say we've got a good fighting chance, but everything you warn against, populism, nationalism, authoritarianism, group warfare, Brexit, closing borders, it's all happening now, isn't it?
Yes, we do have it within us. And that's a reason why I wrote this book, trying to wrap my head around why we often do this historically. We create magnificent civilizations with enormous progress and increase in innovation and productivity. And then we throw it all away because we're also, as you pointed out, tribalists. And we have this tendency to really enter into some sort of societal fight or flight instinct when we begin to think that we should pick fights with everybody, with scapegoats and with foreigners, and to flee the world behind walls and tariff barriers. And that's how most civilizations through history have vanished. And there is that risk today as well.
I'm intrigued by the way you frame history in terms of constant human nature. You say history does not repeat itself, but human nature does. Can I ask you to expand on that a bit?
Yes, I think we're double-natured. The reason why mankind got this far is that we are the best species when it comes to cooperation. If you wonder about that, just look in a mirror. And then you notice that you have, we talk about the whites of our eyes. We have white sclera so that we really broadcast the direction of our gaze, of our eyes to other people. Now, the other, our cousins and other animals, they don't. They often have, most often have brown sclera. So they really keep their attention secret from the rest of the group. And that tells you something important about human beings. Chimpanzees and others, they benefited from keeping their attention secret because if they saw a nice snack or a prey or a potential partner, they wanted to keep it secret from everybody else so that they wouldn't get it instead of them. Whereas to human beings, at some point during our long evolutionary prehistory, it began to make more sense for us to broadcast our attention to others so that because when we saw something, a potential threat or a prey animal, we want others to know so that he can help us to catch it. So that's how we got this far. We are traders. We constantly exchange knowledge, know-how, goods and services with others so that we can make use of the brains, the insights, the knowledge of everybody else. And that's how we conquered the world. And that's the nice part of the story. The problem is that we most likely develop this magnificent ability to cooperate harmoniously in order to kill the others, kill the other tribe. Because when we got to the top of the of all the animals, we reached the pinnacle. No other animal could threaten us once we began to cooperate and could surround the cat animals on the savannah and throw stones at them. They couldn't threaten us anymore. But other human beings could, other tribes could, if they cooperated better than we do. And that's the nasty part of our human nature as well. We cooperate harmoniously, but often within our group. And we're very quick to think in terms of us and them, and very, very concerned about the risk that there's another tribe somewhere else who are conspiring to kill and steal what we have. And therefore, we are tempted to always go into group warfare. We are tempted by demagogues who point out that there's another dangerous group that threatens everything that we've accomplished. And that's why we cooperate better than all the other animals, but we're also, unfortunately, able to throw it away and destroy it and kill in an industrial scale, unlike other animals.
And it was trade, wasn't it, that shaped us who we are? I mean, after coming down from the trees and evolving as Homo sapiens. And that inflection point is really interesting as well, because you point out that it was probably a change in climate that got rid of the trees. So we were sort of thrown onto the flat earth and then had to survive. But way beyond that, I mean, I don't think we've got time today to sweep through the whole of human evolution, but we can have a go, yeah. And the book does it incredibly well in a concise way. But this idea of trade shaping the humans we became, and that double-edged sword, literally, when did we start trading? When did, instead of just forming into tribes and cooperating and making eye contact and killing the other tribe or gaining supremacy over other tribes, when did actual trade start, and what role did language play in opening up our communities to people outside our own tribes and groups?
Yes, this is very interesting, because the deeper archaeologists dig, the further back they push the evidence of trade, of exchange. It seems like trade is as old as mankind itself. When we find the first fossils of Homo sapiens around 300,000 years ago, we have remnants of what happened then in Kenya. We also have amazing relics and specialized tools, spear tips and scrapers and other things that are 300,000 old. And the interesting thing is that they are made from material that couldn't have originated from there, because it's volcanic glass, obsidian, which seems to have originated from sources up to 88 kilometers away. So what archaeologists say is that even as long far back in prehistory, as the very dawn of man, we traded and exchanged. We had long distance trade networks with others. And that is also the same period when we see these great leaps in three important human traits: intelligence, cooperation, and language. And it seems like they all combine to improve the value of the others, because incremental improvements in one of them, in intelligence, for example, makes it possible to communicate in a better way, and then we can cooperate better. So they reinforce the value of each other, and that creates an evolutionary pressure for more cooperation, basically. And this is what made it possible for us to conquer the world. We don't, human beings, we're not that strong, we're not that fast, we can't even fly, and we're bad at swimming, but we have something else. We have each other. And early on, we made use of the brains, the innovation, and the skills and the hard work of everybody else. And that's how we could so quickly dominate the planet.
And apart from opportunists in times of change, you know, like property speculators, when a city is on its knees, like in New York in the 70s, is it possible that some of the players in the world and on the domestic stage actually want to encourage the aversion behavior that you see is so dangerous, you know, when we turn against each other and lock up ourselves into our own tribes? So, you know, smart authoritarian players learning from ancient and modern history, as you describe it in the book, they can see how entire civilizations can fall and rise when beset by war, climate change, pandemics, so they can seize and keep power. Is that where we are now?
Oh, absolutely. And we are so quick to find our new tribes. It seems like it's really pre-wired and hardwired that we search for this kind of belonging, search for some common denominator with others. But often we do it in terms of something that unites us against the other, a common enemy. And it's so quickly, as you know, just look at sports, as comedian Jerry Seinfeld put it, it's pretty hard to justify loyalty to a sports team, right? Because the players are always changing and the teams are moving to other cities and so on. So we're actually rooting for the clothes when you get right down to it. And many of our tribal instincts are like that. It doesn't take much. Almost arbitrary tribes create a sense of loyalty. We made experiments like that, many psychologists have, where they basically ask people to look at these two paintings of two artists that you've never heard of, and then tell me what you like the best. And then those who prefer Kandinsky, for example, over Klee, the artist, they, when they play economic games afterwards, they begin to try to benefit their own team, so to speak, the other Kandinsky fans, over the others, even though they've never met the others, and they will not meet them afterwards, and they've never ever heard of Kandinsky and Klee before. But even such arbitrary groupings create this sense of loyalty. Not just that we benefit each other, we want to punish the others, the enemies. And this sounds weird and strange until you realize that it probably made sense for our Stone Age brains once upon a time in our prehistory, because the other tribe could have been a lethal threat to us. And this is what someone who wants power, they know exactly that this is how to go about things. They divide and conquer. They create this sense of another enemy. And then it's an enormous temptation for us Stone Age brains to then begin to ignore the things that set us apart in our own tribe. Because the one who still engages in an criticism of our own is a threat to the whole group against that common enemy. So trying to stir up trouble like that, to come up with schemes of dangerous and other tribes and foreigners and groups and scapegoats, is a great way of creating a sense of unity that wasn't there before. And that's very dangerous.
Amazing, isn't it, how you can flip from the joy of belonging, the passion of it. And it really brought to mind the Palio in Siena that I've been lucky enough to witness, where all the horses race around the center square of Siena, the walled city in Italy. And they're all provinces and regions competing against each other, ancient rivalries that literally erupts into a fist fight at the end of thousands of people. But they're kind of celebrating their differences and their colours, just like you say. It's completely arbitrary. They're just men riding around on horses, but it goes back hundreds and thousands of years. And you think then of Italy, you think of Italy and Italians as one state, don't you? You think of one country, but then within that, you've got these tribes and these families. How do we see, how do we stay on our guard against that passion and that joy of belonging to a team or to a country, or patriotism, really? How do we stop that tipping over into violence and aggression and prejudice and evil, for want of a better word?
Yeah, and that's an important question, because obviously it's not all bad. It's a great strength of unity and of happiness and of joy. Team sports is not just the hooligans. It's also most people aren't, most of the football fans aren't hooligans. And the interesting thing is that you can also see that a much more common experience is that football creates new bonds between people. And when I'm abroad with my male friends, I notice that they always bond with complete strangers on trains and in bars over nothing more than their love of football. So in any kind of group, in any business, you want to create that unity and look at the things that unites us, because it's a great source of strength and of joy. The problem is that when it comes at the cost of this common enemy, and that's a great fact of human nature, that when we hear about things that are being done by our own group, we begin to excuse them because we think of them as humans, complex humans with many different intentions and ambitions and fears and joys in life, whereas the others, they probably just did it because they're bad people. And what's strange, what's far away, is always dangerous and worse than we think. Scientists have shown that people who are afraid of spiders think that spiders are bigger than they actually are. So we make up our own illusions, and dangerous, scary illusions about the other group. The key is to constantly remind ourselves that there are these cross-cutting cleavages as well between us all. It's not that it's just us and them, because many on that side might cheer on our team, or they might listen to the same music as we do, or they might be people who have the same kind of education as we do. So those groupings are also incredibly complex and have various identities and senses of belonging. And the moment we remind ourselves that many of the them are actually us when looked at it through another prism, then some of that tribalism is, if not removed, at least it can be harnessed for better uses.
And you are obviously pro-trade and pro-free markets and liberalism. Has trade through the centuries, and more recently liberal capitalism, made us sharper elbowed, more ruthless, more likely to be shameless and exploit other people? Isn't the prioritization of shareholder value, for instance, exactly what Marx and Engels were warning us all against?
Yeah, this is interesting that this has always been the popular interpretation, and very much informed by Marx and Engels constantly complaining that this exchange makes us shameless and ruthless and just looking at how to exploit others. But when you look at how people behave when they exchange, I don't think it's a coincidence that the one era, and that's the modern era, when trade and voluntary exchange has become a global phenomena, is the same era in which we have begun to develop liberal democracies, greater tolerance against minority groups, against other religions, and even though we hear about all the geopolitical troubles, actually created a longer period of peace between great powers than we've ever had before. And that's because trade does something else than take the ruthless within us and turn that into ideology. It makes us see the other groups. It makes us think of other people as not just another tribe that might be a threat to us, but also in terms of what do they have to offer, what can they do and accomplish, and what do we have to offer them. So actually, when researchers go into various communities around the world and play these different economic games where people are asked, so how much are you willing to share to come up with some sort of mutual benefit with somebody else? And do you think in terms of more generosity? The shocking thing to many of the researchers is that people who depend, communities who depend on market exchange in their daily lives, are more willing than others to make generous offers than those who don't. And they're also, interestingly enough, they're more interested in punishing ungenerous offers at a cost to themselves in these various games. And that tells you, according to the researchers, it tells you that people in non-market societies display less concern with fairness or even punishing unfairness than those who are market integrated. It's counterintuitive to us, and this is not the popular interpretation in the when we debate ideology, but it seems like trade actually makes us a bit more interested in taking other people into account. And that's also, I think, why the great humanitarian revolutions of our era, thinking of other groups as human beings with something to offer, that came with trade and the growth of globalization around the world.
And we can't be passive, you say, in this fight to prevent the environment, politics, climate, you know, displacement, immigration, prejudice. We have to fight against it. But what I find personally very difficult is we're not looking at fighting the left or fighting the right. It's the extremes of both that we're fighting. And it's quite hard to fight for moderation. And you tackle this a bit in the book. What would be your tips as a historian, as somebody who looks across, you know, economic and geographical areas in space and time? What do you think works? You know, how do we fight for the moderate?
That's the key, right? Because this hostility to what's new and strange and innovative and threatens the way we used to do things comes in many shapes and forms and in many colors. We have this kind of a reactionary attitude in, it comes in sort of red varieties, sort of trying to stop some of the creative destruction in the economy from happening, and with new investments, innovation and trade. But it also comes in sort of the blue or the or whatever color you wish, conservative version, when you fear that the culture, our traditions, the family is being undermined by this. And they are really all different ways of trying to create control. And that's also a natural human need to get some sense of stability and control. The problem, if you're trying to control the world, is that you're trying to stop everybody else from having a control of their own lives, because the result, the innovation, the change that comes with openness is just the result of several billion people allowed to use their own plan according to their own brains and their own sense of what's rational in their own lives. Now we see this kind of reaction both from the left and the right, intolerance against dissenters and immigrants and innovators and eccentrics in various versions. They are allowed, but they are not the majority. They are allowed because they often dominate politics, but there is, I think, an exhausted majority somewhere in between who are just trying to improve their own lives. And by doing that in culture and in business, they are improving the lives for everybody else. That's the great majority. But they just don't have time for all these very loud and obnoxious debates that are going on in politics. And that makes it so difficult, because then the fringes, the various fringes, get an unproportionate power.
And it's difference which is driving us apart, which is, but ironically, is what's beautiful about life and exciting is diversity. But we see things too quickly in terms of black and white or left and right, red and blue. When it's the, you know, it's the kaleidoscope of difference that keeps us all together. It's the multitudes within us, isn't it, that make us the same. And I think that, you know, reading your book and getting a historical perspective on it really is, I suppose, for a society, humbling, because you say, look, this has happened before. This situation has happened before. We mustn't let what happened before happen again, where literally civilization fails. But I do feel that you talk about the authoritarian, and very clearly you state that we should not trust the populist. The populist will tell us what we want to hear. The populist will say that there is a movement of people, the people's voice, but they are really only ever self-interested in history. who is out there at the moment representing diversity and moderation and acceptance? Who on the world stage, can you tell me? Because you have a different view than I do, as anyone else does. Who can you see? Is it, where is that the courage to be compassionate? Who is representing that politically?
Well, they don't get many votes right now, do they? I think that I'd like to come back to another thing. Because, you know, we all have this fight or flight instinct. It's one of the oldest traits. Every animal has it. When we fear the world, we want to retreat, flee, or fight. And that's what happens to societies as well in times of crisis. And we are in a time of crisis, partly because we've had a couple of, even though we've made enormous progress, and you cannot be a historian without being some sort of an optimist, because you learn that most people live with a life expectancy around 30 and with extreme poverty levels around 90%, even in the richest parts of the world. We've made enormous progress, but we also tend to experience crisis of various sorts, financial crises, the migration crisis, geopolitical tensions, the pandemic now. And when those things happen, it activates that part of our brains that tells us that we are under threat. So we have to fight back, man the barricades and fight back, or flee from the world. And I think that social media and generally the 24-hour news cycle has accelerated this fear factor, because we always needed the dramatic latest breaking news immediately, because it could have been a threat to our lives. Sort of, here comes the predator, or there's a fire somewhere. It could threaten us, so we had to be worried and concerned about it immediately. Now, with this 24-hour news cycle and with social media, there's a fire going on somewhere all the time, and then that will top the news cycle everywhere, and we will see it in our cell phones immediately, and we'll transmit it to the rest of the world as well. And that is a dangerous way of scaring ourselves to death, in a way. I think we exaggerate what's dangerous in the world, and when that happens, the political forces that tells us that we can protect you, here is the strong man or the big government who can protect you against this dangerous world. Everybody else is out to get you, but I can protect you. And I think both the radical left and the populist right, they have basically that same message. And it's so tempting for our Stone Age brains, because we think of threats in terms of someone that we should fight against. And that doesn't leave much room for moderation, for long-term thinking, and for cooperation. International cooperation is just a manner of fighting back right now. And that's why they are in the ascendant right now. And it's difficult to find sources of moderation. I think they come from other places than politics right now. I think we can find them in business, I think we can find them in academia, I think we can find them in our popular culture, in the media, in among artists and other places, but not right now in politics.
What's really interesting when you mention business, you would imagine grows because of sustainable ideas, innovation, hard work, a market, you know, to trade with, the more markets, the better. But the financial system where we see great wealth being created is in financial transactions, you know, high frequency trading, the very high frequency trading that might benefit from crisis, you know, ups and downs in the market, fluctuations. And it's really hard. I was having this chat with my wife this morning, and she was telling me not to be so conspiratorial, but it's really hard not to overlay when you look at what's happening around the world, who benefits from disruption and who does not benefit from disruption. You know, a business or of whatever size, you know, from a small business to a conglomerate cannot function and cannot benefit from this kind of disruption that we're in now. But traders, hedge funds, short futures can definitely benefit from fluctuations in trade. How do we make people aware of that? And are you in the kind of Rutger Bregman camp, who thinks that the end of neoliberalism, neoliberalism has had its day, and now we have to find something new?
I think that business is a source for moderation for two reasons. First of all, business has to be long term. There are exceptions, obviously, and let's go into that. But it is about the future. You invest in what you think will be sustainable longer term. Whereas for politicians, it's often what's sustainable until the next election cycle, basically. And the other reason is that as a business person, you have to consider everybody else's potential partners, associates, markets. So oftentimes, when I listen to businessmen, they are the ones who are trying to moderate the message of tribalism coming from politicians and populists. And that is very interesting, I think. When it comes to finance, I think that's also in itself a source for long-term thinking. It's a way of making dreams come true right now, even though there is a market for them only in the longer term. It's a way to bridge the time span that sets us apart from a potential and more beneficial future. But obviously, every kind of investment and speculation is not like that. It's often speculates in short-term changes in various places. Now, that can also be a source of moderating shifts and changes. If you are speculating in the idea that this particular fear in a certain part of the market is not in accordance with its long-term prospects, then short-term speculation in the other direction is a way of moderating that sudden change of perspective and perception. However, obviously, there are people who benefit from a crisis as well, and invests while the guns are blazing, definitely. And we do have examples of people who would love to stoke a crisis, obviously, because they could benefit from it. And then I think that the best disinfectant is sunshine and transparency.
And do you think that we are entering a new age of, say, compassionate capitalism?
I think that the enormous investments that'll take to solve something like climate change, the trillions of dollars that it takes to invest in new energy sources and new fuels and the whole infrastructure surrounding that, can only happen through finance and through capitalism, because they can see the long-term value of something that we can all see a long-term value in. But that's the only way to make it possible right now to start changing things like that. And partly, I think that's just because there is a potential profit. It's capitalism in itself, but also because it's a device that channels and uses the change in preference that we all have, that happens as we get more educated about the world's problem, as we hopefully become more tolerant, humanitarian, and think about the world longer term. Then you can see that both the market, as consumers, as workers, we began to demand something else from our businesses and from our politicians as well. And therefore, businesses have to change according to how we all change, because in the end, the customer is king.
Well, thank you for sharing the long view of history of that kingdom and that domain with me today, Johan, and giving me a much longer perspective for the future. Thanks for sharing your OMI with Bukomi.
Thank you so much.
Johan's book, Open, The Story of Human Progress, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. And if you enjoyed this Bokomi pod, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe and remember, the pubs may close at 10, but your mind can open 24 hours a day. Bye for now.